Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Insidious: The Red Door, which is the fifth film in the series and fifth chronologically, which is a pleasant change because...
Yes, and fifth quantitatively. Qualitatively, I meant to say.
Oh, really? You see, yeah. We might differ a little bit on that.
I barely remember The Last Key, directed by our erstwhile nemesis, Adam Robitel, if I'm not mistaken. So yeah,
it's
I don't know if that's the other one that's
the villain for... in The Last Key is named Keyface.
That's true, but I've never liked any of the demonic ne'er-do-wells in any of these movies, going all the way back to the first one, and indeed, he's the one that we're treated to yet again in the interest of bringing things full circle. I guess I think they called her the Black Bride. The Black Bride was okay in the first movie when she was very peripheral, and then the second one was all about her, and it turned out she was an evil transvestite,
which yes,
kind of put a damper on all that.
Yes, it was all the way back in 2013. It was a different...
I can't get that out. Yeah, right, simpler time. Even then, I thought it was just, I don't know, even if you strip away the problematic layer of it, it's still just lore overkill. I thought so at the time and still feel that way, but now you have all this additional baggage of the cringe factor.
Right. Just to give a quick rundown of the series, I'm going to try not to get too bogged down here, which may be easier said than done. But the first film, Insidious, is the third chronologically. It follows a family, Josh and Renee Lambert, Patrick Wilson and Rose Byrne, respectively, and their two sons and one infant daughter. The older son's name is Dalton. He's the only one who really matters. Dalton basically falls into a coma. And then he's accosted by evil spirits, more or less. And we discover, thanks to the ever-present Lin Shaye, that, in fact, he is not in a coma. He's just stranded in a nether realm called The Further, which is probably the worst thing about Insidious, the first film, namely that name.
Well, and every sequel has given them the opportunity to retire it, and they doggedly refuse. It's one of the first words spoken aloud in this movie, and then they tease it at various points. Because the whole movie is about the characters trying to remember their experiences in The Further.
Well, the funniest part to me is, and this is a flashback probably just to Insidious Part 2 or whatever the hell the second one's called, where the guy's like putting them under and trying to suppress their memories. And he says, there is no such place called The Further. And then literally about 8 seconds later, he's like, and you're allowing the darkness to slip further and further and further. You don't want to be reinforcing that word, buddy. How long have you been doing this job?
It was like the hypnotherapist in Office Space. it makes him psychologically incapable of caring about his job. It's like way down.
Oh, shit.
You're not. I don't think you're accomplishing what you think you're accomplishing.
No. Anyhow, going to get into this more during the synopsis or after the break, but they've also found it impossible to retire Lin Shaye's character, who dies at the end of the first film, lest we forget.
Yeah, four movies ago.
She is murdered by a possessed Patrick Wilson, who basically, after going into The Further and saving his son, gets possessed along the way. And then the second movie is about how he's possessed... He's possessed by, I think his son was being haunted by the Black Bride, who, as you said, is actually an evil transvestite. He's an evil transvestite because there's also a woman in white who it turns out was his mother, who was, I guess, I don't know.
I don't remember.
I looked all this stuff up, so I do know. I'm just trying to say it as quickly and painlessly as possible. Basically, she was forcing her son to dress up in women's clothes, and so she broke him psychologically.
Yeah, I vaguely remember that. The Black Bride worked as a sequel hook at the end of the first movie, and then it was something of a Trojan horse a couple years down the line when Insidious 2 actually came out, and you got all of this unasked for, you know, Norman Bates, warmed over leftovers.
Right. That movie ends with both the woman in white and woman ? In black having been beaten back, and the hypnotherapist wipes out their memories, and that's all well and good. The next two films in release order were both prequels. The first was, I can't even remember what... Do they call it, like, Insidious Part 3, even though it's a prequel?
I think it's called Chapter 3, actually. But don't quote me on that.
Anyway.
That was the one that Lee Whannell directed, and I remember it being an improvement over 2, but still nothing to write home about. Probably needless to say, I've not gone back and revisited any of these movies since I first watched them.
Yeah, I blitzed through some Wikipedia synopses both before and after seeing The Red Door. When I say before and after, it's not like I read them through twice each. I managed to read 1 and 2 before, and then I read about the prequels afterwards. The dumbest thing about the third film is that the villain is called something like The Man Who Can't Breathe, and his character/demon design, he's got like an oxygen mask, and the way that the teenage girl protagonist eventually defeats him is by taking the mask off of an old man's face so he can't breathe anymore, essentially.
Yes. Take that, The Man Who Can't Breathe.
It's like... Now you can't breathe.
That's a hell of a kryptonite, I gotta say.
Yeah,
wild. No, my one weakness. My useless lungs.
Damn my emphysema.
Curse my inability to respirate unaided. I don't remember that. That sounds dumb as hell.
Oh, yeah.
For whatever reason, and I don't really know why this would be the case, there must be some middle to that Venn diagram that has slipped through my fingers. Maybe you can help me out on this. It's probably not even worth it, even if you could. I find Conjuring 2 and Insidious 3 are tangled up inextricably in my mind, like Christmas tree lights being pulled out of an old box. I think I'm thinking of one, and then I realize I'm thinking of the other. And like Christmas tree lights, I'm not really inclined to put in the effort.
They don't cost that much to replace.
To do that disentangling, yeah.
Yeah, I can't say I've had that problem. I just remember Insidious, here we go. I'm having trouble with the names. But no, Conjuring Part 2 is the one that takes place in the UK. I remember that.
Yeah, it's the site of a famous exorcism, I want to say, or a famous haunting. I think that there's a ghost in that movie who you're led to believe is the big bad, who is kind of an asthmatic old man, and then it turns out that he was just a victim of a previous haunting. And I think they also tease the crooked man in that movie who has yet to get his own moment in the spotlight.
I think the crooked man has been nerfed for good. I think they gave up on that.
It didn't even give him his 15 minutes and fucking, you know, they found time for the Black Shook in Annabelle Comes Home, but not for the... Not for the poor crooked man. What a shame. It's funny remembering how fucking crowded all of this used to be. I mean, I know I'm talking about the Conjuring movies now, and I've kind of switched streams here.
It's all James Wan.
Yeah.
It's all the same soup. So anyway, the last film that came before this one was Insidious: The Last Key. Takes place, I think, just prior to the first Insidious film in the internal chronology. It follows Lin Shaye's character, Elise, basically goes back to investigate a haunting at her childhood home, sort of an Elise origin story, which nobody really asked for. And as I said, the villain's name is Keyface, because he has a key face.
He does not have a key face. He has keys for fingers.
Oh, that's right.
It's a complete fucking misnomer.
I forgot that. His name should have been Keyfingers. Keyfingers. So that's basically the rundown before we get to this film. I'd just like to say, real quick, the sort of almost omnipresent, at least in the like mainline Insidious films, 1, 2, and Red Door. He's just this red guy who's...
Yeah,
who's...
he's like an incubus Darth Maul. He's just... Yeah. I think they call him Lipstick Face, never in the movies, but like if you look on the wikis, he's like called the Lipstick Demon, I believe.
I looked into this. He is credited on IMDb as Lipstick Face Demon.
Okay.
And incidentally, played by the film's composer, which is slightly interesting. Google brings up an excerpt from the Insidious Wiki, which is not a thing that should exist.
Well, I mean,
I know. That ship has sailed forever ago. I'm just saying.
Wiki culture gets a lot dumber than that.
He's also known as the man with the fire in his face.
Oh, God.
Now, this excerpt has pieces of information from the little biographical sidebar that's in wiki articles of this type.
Yeah, my favorite are the vital statistics. I think it's like Heroes Wiki or like Villains Wiki will like assign them characteristics, like you're picking them on a character select menu in a video game. Even for like side characters who barely have a character, there'll be my favorite being, and I showed this to you once upon a time, the like jerk cop who's always antagonizing Bob Hoskins in Who Framed Roger Rabbit is like
right.
his key characteristics. One of them was that, let's see, I'm gonna pull it up.
Okay.
I remember I got to it by Googling a quote that I was trying to remember. The rabbit
cacked him last night. Yeah,
Marvin Acme, the rabbit cacked him last night. There's too many goddamn... I'm on the wrong wiki.
Jesus.
Never mind. Okay. It might have been... Even by wiki culture, it might have been deemed unnecessarily detailed. And stricken from the internet. I will keep searching in the background here.
So, Lipstick Face Demon, the two attributes that the Google excerpt has pulled from this wiki article are as follows. Health. Indestructible.
We should be so lucky.
Status, alive.
In a sense.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, he lives in the further where everyone is supposed to be dead. So
right. Extant might be a better word.
Anyway, we've spent the better part of 15 minutes unpacking all of this useless lore. To give the briefest of rundowns of the concept behind this film before Matt launches into the synopsis proper, Insidious: The Red Door takes place 9 years after the events of the second film. Josh, Patrick Wilson, is estranged from his family. Apparently, he has had brain fog, like he has long COVID, and I don't know. That made him difficult to be around. Whatever. Point is, they're estranged. Dalton, his son, who was also astral projecting around, is now a grumpy 18-year-old about to head off to art school for college. And the memories start trying to push their way back through. And by memories, I, of course, mean the demons. That's kind of...
Ever so slowly, it takes them the better part of the movie's full runtime to fully jog their memories, which I think is a big hurdle for this movie to clear. I think that the scares would have to really be effective in order to make up for the fact that they are slow to put the pieces together, and we, having watched all of these movies, are way ahead of them the whole time. And so for me, when the scares did not land, it gave me very little to chew on.
Yeah, for sure.
So, without further ado, Lieutenant Santino is a supporting character in Disney's Touchstones 1988 hybrid film Who Framed Roger Rabbit. He is an LAPD detective lieutenant and a friend of Detective Eddie Valiant. I remembered him being a little more antagonistic, but he's characterized as a do-gooder here, so I might be misremembering that great, great film. Occupation, police officer. Affiliations, Los Angeles Police Department. Home, Los Angeles, California. Likes, bringing justice. Dislikes, Eddie's behavior, the dip.
Oh, I'd forgotten that. That is very good.
All right, I'm glad that's still up.
The rabbit cacked him last night.
So we open with the hypnotherapist, whatever, shrink, inducing memory loss in the father and son. There is no place called the further. The further is getting further and further away.
Further, further, further.
Cut to 9 years later. The family's at a funeral. So we don't know right off the bat that there's been a divorce because this is a function where they are all together as a unit, but we quickly figure out that mom and dad are separated. It is, I think, her mother's funeral. It's no, the Barbara Hershey character.
It's his mom, yeah.
Okay, well, I knew it was Barbara Hershey.
Right.
The son, Dalton, the astral projector who got them into all that trouble when he fell off the stepladder in the first movie as a young tyke, is a surly teenager, and the movie has very little use for the other kids and relatively little use for the mom. I wonder, because for me the divorce didn't work as a dramatic device, and I wonder if it was just a screenwriting contrivance, you know, a divorce of convenience, because the actress, whose name escapes me, didn't want to be front and center for the fifth outing.
Rose Byrne only wanted like 3 or 4 shooting days.
Yeah, that's really how it plays, because Patrick Wilson, it quickly becomes sort of two parallel lines where you've got the Dalton stuff after he goes off to college, and you've got the Patrick Wilson stuff. And the Patrick Wilson stuff is all one-man show for the most part. And yeah, that feels like a miscalculation. It feels like he should have had somebody in his corner, if not the wife, then somebody. Dalton is assigned a sidekick, or that also would have been a one-man show, and I found his sidekick immensely irritating, but more on that later. The psychiatrist from the prologue shows, I guess we're still in the prologue because the title drop hasn't happened yet. The psychiatrist is sort of being squirrely, you know, out amongst the tombstones, and he catches Patrick Wilson's attention and does just a piss poor job of not dredging a bunch of stuff back to the surface. He's just acting kind of ominous and mysterious. And Patrick Wilson's like, "Don't I know you?" And the psychiatrist's like, "No." It's just like, his poker face is just woeful. And weirdly, correct me if I'm wrong, his character never comes back.
I don't think it does, no.
Which is, it's strange that they would bring him up twice in the first 5 to 10 minutes and then never again. You would think that he had served his function, just giving them the magic movie amnesia for him to then recur a second time. You expect a third run-in where there's some truth-telling. If nothing else, it would hasten the epiphanies, which are very slow to arrive in this movie, by and large.
Yeah.
But we never see him again. And then I glanced down at my phone. There must be something to... I looked back up and there was a title drop, a kind of ostentatious, like, insidious title drop. Something spooky must have happened that I missed to punctuate that, or to in some way justify it. I know that Patrick Wilson is in his car. He's texting. They're doing the, like, texts up on screen and little bubbles thing that I almost always hate. Mm-hmm. And behind him, like through the rear windshield, we can see a blurry out of focus figure. Did that thing get spooky somehow, or like what happened when I was looking away?
I don't know, man. Clearly nothing memorable.
Yeah, okay, moving on then. What is Patrick Wilson's name?
Josh.
Josh. Okay. Josh drives Dalton to art school, and there's a wacky mix-up where he is given a female roommate who right off the bat just kind of talks like a character on a live-action Disney Channel sitcom. It feels like
yeah.
something that was not just like never cool, but like it's an approximation of cool that was always wrong and is now dated. It's like,
right,
you know,
right.
It's very strange. At one point she says interwebs, not in this scene, but around like the midpoint of the movie, at which point I knew there was no salvaging this character. She could have had a monologue.
She could have punched Fireface in his face.
In his face of fire. Or lipstick, depending on who you ask. I think lipstick and fire have fuck all to do with each other, personally. But what can you do? She is just very sort of vintage 09-10 manic pixie dream girl right off the bat. She challenges Dalton their first night in the room, and indeed only night in the room, because the powers that be are going to rectify this error and assign them more fitting roommates. She's like, okay, tell me, I can't remember if they're playing like two truths and a lie or how it's presented, but they're telling each other weird facts about one another.
It just starts with her saying, what's weird about you? Basically, it's something almost like that verbatim. It's like, tell me something weird about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, she takes a shine to him right away and just never lets up. She's very persistent, and he is like mumbly and taciturn and kind of sullen and greasy-haired. And it almost, it's written, and I debated whether to even bring this up because I don't really know what I'm talking about, but it's written almost like a harem anime where like the wacky female character is incredibly taken with this just random mope for reasons totally passing understanding. And he just sort of stands around going like.
So Insidious the Red Door is horror movie Tenchi Muyo. Is that what you're saying?
Well, that reference is lost on me. This leg of it is, anyway, like I said, it's parallel tracks for much of the rest of the runtime. Her weird thing, the first thing she volunteers, which feels like very Zoe Deschanel or Zoe 101, as the case may be. She talks about how on Sundays she wears monocles and orders takeout in a British accent. How terribly kooky.
Yes.
And then he talks about how he doesn't remember being 10 years old. He was in a coma. He doesn't remember being sick. Doesn't even really remember getting well. And she's kind of intrigued by that. And that's the only real function of this scene, is to get that information betwixt the two of them. Dalton goes to art class. We get a few art class scenes throughout the movie. They're not really worth touching on one by one, but this one sets the template for them, which is that in discovering his inner artist, he is getting back in touch with the further. And indeed, our first impression of his art instructor is that she is a demon from the further. She like singles out one of his classmates and is like, your art is shit, rip it up and wipe your ass with it, you know, basically. it's like whiplash out of nowhere. She just like this like J.K. Simmons, you know, drill instructor character comes out and is sort of only useful insofar as she accidentally coaxes these dark visions out of
visions.
Dalton. Yeah,
sorry, there was a trailer for The Nun 2 ahead of this film when I went and saw it. So
that's an oracular vision of our future, and a dark one at that.
Correct. The difference between the art teacher and J.K. Simmons in Whiplash is that J.K. Simmons in Whiplash fakes being friendly for like a brief stretch early on before he throws things and says, not my fucking tempo.
Uh-huh.
She just starts in at 11.
Well, and this movie, I assume, has been in production for like just barely too long for this to be a possibility. But it's not like the kid brought in a piece of AI art or something, you know,
no.
where she would be justified in laying into him the way she does. It's just, it's not her tempo. But she takes a liking to Dalton, naturally, and he starts painting, and he paints a red door. And she asks him, you know, is it keeping you out or keeping you in? Which is kind of an interesting question to pose. Not much is done with it. And at one point in the scene, she instructs them all to go further and further into yourselves. Again, laying it on real thick. The best scare sequence in the movie does happen with Patrick Wilson, the one-man show. So that track, that leg, gets off to a strong start. He goes in for an MRI because he's got all this brain fog.
Mm-hmm.
There's a funny scene when he's dropping his kid off at the dorms when he's just like, yeah, I just, I've felt kind of, I've had this, I've just been kind of distracted for the last few years. He says it kind of offhandedly, like he's apologizing for his behavior over a period of at most weeks, and then he right. just tacks years onto the end.
For a few years.
You know, since he hit puberty, give or take. This scene in the MRI is fairly spooky and kind of classic Insidious, very dark, quiet bang kind of stuff, visually just lightless. I mean, he's in the MRI, the power goes out, there's something in there with him with bright little beady eyes, and then it scrambles towards him and the lights snap on and the doctor says, you nodded off in there.
Yeah, you've been asleep 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, MRIs are an uncomfortable, claustrophobic experience to begin with, so that's a good scene, a good staging of that kind of scare. Less effective is Dalton and his lady friend, waifu, whatever, going to a frat party at her behest, and no, that's not worth getting into.
So, if you'll allow me to take this one.
Please.
Because, at least for me, this sequence was a bit of a roller coaster. Basically, after the frat party is kicked off by head douche bro, whose name is apparently Nick the Dick, very frat appropriate, he kicks
Nick
off.
The Dick, Nick
yeah,
the
there's
Dick.
A chant. He kicks off the party while wearing a diaper and whatnot. Dalton and friend waifu end up in Nick's bedroom because, I don't know, they're just poking around aimlessly. And then Dalton, once he's alone for a while, he hears this kid just like violently throwing up
yeah,
in
just puking
the bathroom.
His guts out. Just... And Nick the Dick had previously alluded in a would-be rousing speech, you know, like Germans bombing Pearl Harbor style speech to his frat bros about how there was an incident, you know, the previous year, previous semester, whatever, that, you know, was bad PR. It was bad for the frat and don't drink too much. That sort of thing.
Yeah, pace yourself. And yeah, this kid is just puking like a comic amount. Like
it is. It's like a Family Guy gag where, like, you know, Peter or somebody is just like puking for 10 straight minutes and they just milk it as long as they possibly can.
He pukes the contents of like 18 human stomachs. And then he looks up and he's got kind of like dead kid face that's also got puke on it. And it's like,
yeah.
Close the door, which we find out later is a double entendre. Not a sexual one, just a regular one.
Yes, the titular door.
Correct. And Dalton does, and then short time later, he's hiding under Nick's bed for reasons that don't matter. And eventually, the dead kid comes out of the bathroom and tiptoes towards
the
bed.
Through the tulips.
We'll fucking get there.
Yeah, indeed.
And we see his feet from under the bed. And as stupid as the buckets of vomiting is, this is almost played well just for a hot second because the kid's ghost is slow enough in like crouching down and bending down to look under the bed. It's dragging it out long enough that it's different enough from the typical quiet, bang, rush at you thing that these movies do.
Yeah.
That I was vibing with it a little bit. I was feeling it. And then the movie proceeds to immediately piss all over that by having the ghost scramble over the top of the bed as Dalton is scrambling out from underneath and just projectile vomits into his face like we're watching Drag Me to Hell.
Well, at least we don't get an Angel of the Morning needle drop a la It Chapter 2.
True. Yes. So, yeah, bit of a roller coaster for me. I'm like, this is stupid. Oh, wait, maybe it's good. No.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the whole thing, and I'm with you on the slowness being to the movie's benefit gets you a little bit more into that, like, turn of the millennium J-horror kind of headspace.
Yeah, exactly.
Where you wish that the movie would show mercy and just get the damn thing over with, but it's kind of, you know, an exquisite discomfort that you're being made to feel. This is by no means as well executed as the best J-horror of 20-some years ago, but it's not bad. But I overall, I found the whole fraternity episode a little needless. I particularly had no idea what to make of all the Nick the Dick stuff until you saw the ghost, and then I thought, okay, well, they needed to set up the idea that a kid choked on his own vomit or something, and just the idea that he is now vomiting forever in hell, I guess, is, like, completely awful. That's kind of, you know, cosmologically horrifying in a way that I don't even know if these movies have ever flirted with before. They don't really deal with ghosts that often. They mostly just deal with demons, like denizens of the further who belong there, like imps and shit. I don't know. But this is a little more kind of sixth sensey, like the kid who's like, do you want to see where my dad keeps his guns? And then he turns around and the back of his head has been blown out, you know, that kind of thing. Set up and payoff with the ghosts that are, like, forever marred by the manner of their demise kind of do give me the willies. I like that trope when it's done well. Here it's done only okay. So, close the door. Yeah, a double entendre. They put this together in a subsequent scene. I'm sure I'm skipping over some Patrick Wilson stuff here, but his one-man show got very overdrawn for me. I didn't really like the Dalton stuff either. I kind of got the feeling oscillating back and forth between the two. It reminded me of when you're carrying something heavy one-handed and your, like, left arm gets tired, and so you pass it to your right arm for some relief. But then the longer you have to do that, like if you're coming back from the grocery store or something, you keep passing the heavy thing back and forth, and it gives you the relief is more fleeting every time. So, like, I wasn't vibing with the Patrick Wilson stuff, and then it would cut back to Dalton, and I'd be like, okay, change of pace, and then I would remember that I didn't like the Dalton stuff very much, and it would cut back to Patrick Wilson, and I was just passing the heavy thing back and forth, left and right, and eventually both of my arms were sore enough that it just didn't matter. I don't know, a weird analogy, perhaps, but that's what it put me in mind of. They, meaning Dalton and his once roommate, she is very loyal to him. This is what sells the kind of, like, harem anime thing. She is willing to brave mortal peril for him, despite them having met due to random happenstance and just shared a room and four walls.
For an evening.
For one evening, yeah.
Well, and not to mention, after they have their one really dangerous brush with the further, or their first one, where, you know, she ends up getting, like, choked until she's unconscious by a demon or something. The scene immediately afterwards, he, like, catches up to her outside the campus health center or whatever. I just wanted to see if you're okay. She's like, I can't do this with you. It's too dangerous. And then the next time he's doing this dangerous thing, she leaps right into the fray.
Yeah, she shows up and is like, so I've been doing some Googling on the interwebs, and then she pulls out, well, we'll get there in just a moment. First, they have a whole conversation about close the door, and they spell out exactly what it means, and I think they even go back to the frat, don't they? I mean, because she's like, what do you want to do, go ask him for clarification?
Yeah.
And then it turns out that's actually Dalton's plan. So I found the first frat episode kind of pointless, and then they go back to the well. Well, that for me was dry to begin with. And I just thought, you know, I don't like the device typically. And, you know, like, I could see a version of this movie that's 20 minutes shorter where they get into the further during the climax and they're going to seal the door. They're going to close the door once and for all. He's looking at the red door, Dalton is, and there's a flashback to Puke Ghost going, close the door, close the door. And then Dalton's like, close the door. And, you know, and he, like, puts it together in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
That would have been dumb, but at least it's economical. Here, they figure it out way in advance, and it's just so much more belabored.
Yeah.
And then later on, she does do a bit of Googling on the interwebs, and then she pulls up a video, first of the two comedy Ghostbuster characters from the original Insidious, and at least one of the prequels, if not both.
Yeah, Lee Wannell and his much more imposing buddy.
Yeah. And they have a YouTube series channel, something or other, where they talk about astral projection and a range of other paranormal subjects. So they watch a video of the two of them, and then they watch a video of Lynn Shea giving a lecture about the further. And it was just taking me back to Sinister and the weird Vincent D'Onofrio cameo where he just Skypes into the movie for 2 minutes to tell us about Bagul. It's such a thankless, like, inelegant kind of way to spring those cameos on us. In the case of Sinister, it wasn't a cameo because it was the first movie in a series. Vincent D'Onofrio was not a fan favorite character or anything. It was a cameo in the sense that he's a name. But here, it just seems like kind of a lazy way to shoehorn in these familiar faces who the fans are presumably clamoring for. And we got a little bit more Lin Shaye on our way out, which is, I found, also unsatisfying, but at least a little more high effort than a fucking YouTube video. So the crux of it comes down to Dalton needing to move past, he needs to first remember that his dad, while possessed, attacked him and attacked his mother and tried to kill them both and his miscellaneous X number of siblings who this movie doesn't have time for. And he needs to remember that, and then he needs to work on it and move past it so he and his dad can come together. And that was mainly what Insidious 2 was about. I mean, Patrick Wilson kills Lin Shaye at the very end of the first Insidious, which is kind of, it's a pretty brazen ending, and I think an effective one. It's way better than the ending of Insidious 2, which I just remembered is maybe the worst cliffhanger of any movie I've ever seen. It's just Lin Shaye as a ghost, mind, going with the Ghostbusters to this haunted house, talking to this little girl, and then Lin Shaye looks over her shoulder with a fearful expression and goes like, "Oh my God," and then cut to black roll credits. It's never been followed up on, as far as I know. Never see that little girl or her family again. Totally fucking brain dead. Anyway, it's a little weird to me. So granted, you get a little killer Patrick Wilson at the very end. I'm talking last minute of the first Insidious, but that's mostly an Insidious Chapter 2 thing. And it's a little weird that this movie is so, I mean, it's I get it because it's a scarring kind of a Jack Torrancey thing to happen to a boy, but it's a little weird that this movie is so, it hinges so much on the events of Insidious Chapter 2 specifically rather than the first one. It kind of interferes with that coming full circle feeling that the movie is going for. That and the fact that the gang's all here thing is compromised by the YouTube element. Eventually, the mother, Rose something, I believe you said her name was,
Rose Byrne.
fills out the rest of her contractually mandated 8 minutes. She puts in a scene with Patrick Wilson where the two of them realize that their son is in trouble because he texted his kid brother a photo of a painting that is of the further. And Patrick Wilson's memory has come back by this point, more or less. The wife has confessed that she did not get hypnotized, apparently. So she has known the truth this whole time. So Patrick Wilson flies into action. He goes into the further. Dalton goes into the further. And I have always found the further stuff in the third acts of all of these movies to be kind of just a lot of ooky spooky porridge, just kind of a whole lot of this and a whole lot of that. I think that the first Insidious starts out really strong and then kind of falls to pieces by the end. But they always at least had kind of a dry ice fog kind of haunted house, dumb, spooky thing going for them, where it was just like, I don't know, like the further for me has always just felt like a bowl of peeled grapes posing as eyeballs. It's not scary, but it's scary themed. Like, and this time around, I didn't even get that kind of surface level Halloweeny sort of pleasure out of it. I don't know what it is. I had a hard time making out what was happening a lot of the time, just visually, as well as, I don't know, dramaturgically. I didn't, other than closing the door, which they do eventually do, it's hard to say minute to minute what they were trying to accomplish, and the whole thing, it just turns into kind of a miasma, I think. Lipstick Face, or Fire Face, or whatever we're calling him, is on the hunt for Dalton and his dad. And that is a callback to the first Insidious, that sort of closes the loop in a way that some of the other stuff doesn't, some of the other callbacks, but I was never a big fan of his, so that was fan service that was wasted on me. I imagine other people will feel differently.
I certainly don't.
At one point, I think it's when Dalton first gets both feet into the further, so to speak. When he's gets into the further up to his eyeballs, that's when they finally do the Tiny Tim needle drop in this movie. And I thought it was deep enough into the thing that I figured they just weren't going to do it, that they had come to their senses at last. But no, we have one more tiptoe through the tulips to tiptoe through before the curtain closes on this fucking franchise. It's never been scary. I can't conceive of it ever being scary. A talented filmmaker can do anything in theory. I don't know. No filmmaker has ever been such a deft hand at horror that they could make my hairs stand up with Tiny fucking Tim. It just reminds me of the SpongeBob pilot, you know, when he's feeding the sardines. He was a novelty act. He's like a big guy with a goofy falsetto. It's like trying to make me scared of Crazy Frog or something. It's just like it's asinine.
What's the dark secret behind Badger, 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 Badger?
Snake, snake.
Oh, it's a snake.
That part is scarier than Tiny Tim, because you know,
It's a snake.
yeah, right. It
Ooh.
might be poisonous. You don't know. I let out, it was more than a groan. I let out a death rattle when Tiny Tim started playing. Bees can attest to this. It really did take something out of me. But at the end of the day, they close the door. Dalton paints over it, which feels a little bit, I don't know, a little bit, are you afraid of the dark? A little bit goosebumps, even for this series, that, you know, painting over his painting of the door actually seals the spectral door on the astral plane that all these demons have been spilling out of his whole life.
It's like if the way Picture of Dorian Gray ended was if the artist was just brought in to repaint the portrait to look good again.
Why didn't I think of that? I should have done this years ago.
Instead of having to drag him out of the painting and strangle him and climb in after him. Yeah, no. Just paint over it. It's
Yeah.
fine.
And we get two codas. The first is the ghost of Lin Shaye bumping into Patrick Wilson. And it's a little bit like him bumping into the guy at the funeral, actually, where it's kind of a don't I know you thing. But this time he seems to kind of sort of figure out who she is. And she says, you've got a bright future ahead of you. And it's very heartwarming. On the whole, like tonally, this movie strives to be sentimental and kind of sappy. Which was basically as wasted on me as the lipstick fire face fan service was, because I'm not really that emotionally invested in these characters. And then the last scene is of Patrick Wilson taking a look at his son's latest painting, which depicts, I believe, the climax of the first movie with Patrick Wilson carrying his son out of the further, like through the mist. And I love you, boy, you know, and then that's, you know, roll credits.
More after the break.
The balance of light and dark is what we're after.
You're in the art school, I take it?
Yeah. You go here too?
Yes.
Draw an experience that defines you.
When I was 10, I was in a coma. But I don't even remember being sick.
Sink deep into your memory and let's see what light can find.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
I'm seeing crazy stuff. I think these drawings could be clues from my past.
There's so much you don't know, and I was too scared to tell you the truth.
Our family has been keeping secrets. They suppressed our memories, but I can still feel something following us.
There's only one way to find out.
And we're back. Matt, what do you got?
I think the high point was probably that MRI scene for me. I think the low point was the return to the frat and them soliciting Puke Ghost, you know, to shake yeah. him down for information, which is just kind of a harebrained scheme. It's such a, you know, he's effective enough for what he is, but I just found it kind of mind-boggling when I realized that's the direction the movie was going in, because it's a plan that the characters hatch right in front of you. It's the old gag where she says it jokingly, and then he looks at her, and it's like, oh, it's not a joke. This is actually what we're doing. It's like Timon doing the hula dance of a Lion King, you know?
Right.
And it should have just been a joke, because It just felt like a complete waste of time. We gleaned everything we needed from Puke Man, you know, after that first encounter. A lot of this movie, it's, you know, it's not very long. It's like an hour 40, I want to say. Mm-hmm. But it's flabby. It was directed by Patrick Wilson, which I find kind of funny. It's sort of like how when you get to, like, season 4 of Mad Men, you start seeing, like, oh, this episode was directed by Jon Hamm. Oh, this episode was directed, you know, like, the cast start sneaking their way into the Directors Guild.
Right.
He's, you know, he's done his time. He's earned it. And it's not inept, but it's not, I don't think that he's necessarily, you know, I don't think it's his true calling. By any means, I think that a lot of his stuff in particular, at first I thought, because there's a lot of stuff that we didn't talk about Patrick Wilson's dad,
yeah.
who lost his mind and abandoned the family and killed himself.
But as it turned out, he was just fighting the demons in the further, just like the two subsequent generations.
Right. So this comes up early on, and I thought that director Patrick Wilson, perhaps in a moment of vanity, was trying to, like, flesh out his character unnecessarily with all of this dad trauma, and the movie was going to get derailed by that. It doesn't really, in fact, kind of the opposite thing wound up happening. I thought he was going to beef up his role to an embarrassing degree. Instead, his scenes are far and away the thinnest part of the movie.
They're, yeah.
I've already forgotten the vast majority of them because he has no one to talk to, you know, so it'll just cut back to him and he'll be looking at microfiche or something, like doing research on various ghostly happenings. And then he'll have a ghostly happening of his own that's just phoned in and forgettable.
The only one I can really remember, and I think this is just because it was in the trailer or one trailer, is when he's doing some kind of, like, rudimentary memory exercise, like a matching game with pictures of his family. And he's got them taped up with the blank backs facing him, like, taped up in panes of glass on, like, a sliding glass door. And, you know, he flips them and trying to match the things. And then periodically, one particular spot on the door, he'll flip it up. And then he never notices, but we see someone getting gradually closer and closer, and then eventually this person bashes through the sliding glass door. It turns out it's the specter of his father, as we come to find out later. But yeah, in and of itself, that scene is not really memorable. Again, it's just because I saw the trailer a few times at one point, I think, that it stuck.
I think that, and you know, this series, and to a far greater extent, the Conjuring series, used to feel like they were bursting at the seams, standing room only with the various ghouls and the cast of heroes as well. And this movie feels very depopulated. You've got Patrick Wilson and his son, the astral projector, who's all grown up, or all growed up, perhaps, in the manner of a rug rat, because that's kind of how it feels some of the time. And you've got Dalton's sidekick, who's a new character, who I found horribly grating for the most part. And, you know, it just feels like, I don't know, I think the bar has been raised for this sort of thing, even like a mid-tier horror franchise, I'm not saying it has to be the Fast and the Furious part 11 or whatever they're on now, you know, where they're bringing characters back from the dead. Although bringing characters back from the dead would make more sense in this setting.
True.
Than a spy car theft action setting. I don't know. I found it kind of like it's weird for me to say this because I just said before the break that I'm not very emotionally invested in all of these characters, but I did feel a certain hollowness and a certain loneliness not having more of them around. And there's right. often a feeling in franchises like this where they're trying to reconstitute something that they had right chemistry-wise in the first installment. And it's like the Beatles' solo careers, where it's just never going to be quite the same. You know, the Jurassic Park sequels are kind of like that, where it's like, you got Jeff Goldblum in this one, you got Sam Neill in this one, and then, hey, you got all of them again, but it's a Colin Trevorrow movie, you know, made with about...
Locusts.
Locusts, which I still haven't seen. You just can't make that lightning strike twice. And it does feel like you're following the solo careers of bandmates who have broken up when you're watching The Lost World. It's like a Ringo album. And then Jurassic Park 3 is, I don't know, George Harrison or something. I'm abusing the metaphor. But the Insidious...
I would flip-flop those because I like Lost World a lot better than JP3. And same for George versus Ringo.
Yeah, I think I'm with you on both counts. In any case, Insidious is like that. This movie is just all about, put it this way, if this movie were just about the family and there was no Lin Shaye, no Lee Wannell, no Lee Wannell's friend, the big shaggy bastard, I could live with that if it was a movie about, again, to invoke Fast and the Furious, family. But it isn't, because there's been a divorce, but it's like a lowercase d divorce where it's not like a big deal. At one point, Dalton is like, no wonder mom divorced you. So he twists that knife once, but it's not a big sticking point for any of them. And the mother is not really present during any of the climactic shenanigans, not present in the epilogue. So that, too, contributes to the feeling of the movie being underpopulated, for lack of a better word. I did just find it like slightly lonely and hollow and a little depressing, just kind of an also-ran.
Yeah, and they do, like we talked about, bring back Lin Shaye briefly for one of the two codas. I said I was going to talk about this a little bit, and I guess now's the time. I don't know why this franchise could never fucking let go of her. It's
the role she was born to play. I mean, it's
sure.
It's her signature, yeah.
That's fine, but it's almost as if John Carpenter killed Sam Loomis in Halloween 78, and then somehow he kept being resurrected like Michael never dies.
Yeah, if Donald Pleasance's face was showing up in the clouds like Mufasa in Halloween 5 to give the new protagonist advice.
It's so odd. She dies at the end of the first one, and that death, as you said, is good. It's like a really arresting twist right there at the end. And then, yeah, she's got that dopey cliffhanger ending in 2, and then she shows up in 3 and 4 because they're both prequels. And now she's in fucking YouTube purgatory forever.
That's worse than puking forever. I would rather drink myself to death and be the sad frat ghost than be a ghost in the algorithm, as it were.
Yeah, I don't know. I would say they need to let go of her, but I'm hoping that this is the end of the franchise in general, so that's kind of a moot point.
I mean, that's certainly the pitch. That's the best reason, really the only reason, to bring back Darth Maul and just to do... I mean, when she shows up, it's like the last time you see Paul Walker in Furious 7. It's not that maudlin, but it is going for the heartstrings, you know, because she's not actually dead, as far as I know.
Right.
And, you know, I got way more emotional at the end of Furious 7 than I did at any point in this thing, because you feel that loss and you don't hear, because she's been dead for several movies, even on a fictive level, that you've come to terms with that character's passing. Yes. 10 years ago.
In the fictional chronology, she's been dead for 9 years. In real life chronology, her character has been dead for 13 years, because that's when Insidious 1 came out.
Jesus. It's
just, let it go, Indiana. Let it go.
You were just saying, before we started recording post-break, that you were surprised, given that this is a franchise capper and a kind of bad movie at best, that we didn't have more ire or more to say, because it feels like this is the last time for us to get our licks in. If another Insidious movie is not on the horizon, then it's now or never. And I really just don't have that much to say. I don't know how confidently I can say this, because I do not remember Insidious the Last Key. Although I remember that the keys were on his fingers rather than his face. I think his face was a keyhole.
It looked like
something you would fight in Kingdom Hearts. You know, it was just like a really high concept kind of creature design. I mostly remember the key fingers from the poster more so than the actual movie.
Sure. Well, we saw more of that poster than we saw the movie, needless to say.
That's true.
Those posters were kicking around for a few months.
I think, on the whole, Insidious had a better run of sequels than The Conjuring did, just in aggregate, but not like by a huge margin. So I would say that overall it's a series that I am basically happy with and charitably disposed to. I mean, I think that they're kind of ho-hum, but harmless. And so it's not like I've had my knives out for the Insidious movies all this time. Otherwise, I might be using this one as a punching bag. You don't stab a punching bag. Once again, I'm mixing metaphors.
It's your specialty.
Yes. Especially of late. So I don't know. I don't have anything else in the tank. I did not care for it.
Yeah, like we were saying early on in the recording, I think we disagree a little bit in terms of relative rankings of these films. You seem to think that this was kind of the nadir as it was drawing to a close. And I'm fairly confident that I felt The Last Key was pretty woeful. And this is just kind of regular ho-hum to bad.
Last Key was pre-podcast, was it not?
Yeah, I believe so. I think it was like a January release in 2018.
Okay. January is, Adam Robitel's stomping ground, so that tracks.
Yeah. And then the third movie is, I mean, I don't actually remember how well or poorly it was executed necessarily, but the fact that the antagonist is defeated by taking off his oxygen mask in the further is also pretty stupid. So, I don't know. This one is either the third or fourth best movie in this series, probably. And it's a series on the whole that I am perhaps marginally less positively disposed toward than you are. But on the whole, I think I agree with you in that while I'm surprised this episode isn't going to run longer and we didn't have more bile about it, when I really sit and think about it, it kind of makes sense. There's just not a whole lot of there.
Well, I think part of the reason that you get so many stupid KOs in movies like this, and the Conjuring movies are afflicted by this, I think, to an even greater degree.
Oh, definitely.
Is that those movies kind of trend towards wholesomeness at the end of the day. When the dust is settled, it's all about, it's just very Reaganite, you know, it's like it's family values all the way down. Less so in this one, because there has been a divorce, but like I keep saying, that felt more like a convenient screenwriting contrivance than anything else, just to keep the wife out of the action, or to keep the actress out of the action, as the case may be.
Yeah.
But all of these movies do require a definitive triumph of good over evil in this sort of Disney-esque way. And so it's like, how do you definitively kill a ghost? You know, whatever answer you supply to that question is bound to be at least a little bit silly. Some movies can get away with it. It helps if you're a horror comedy. But oftentimes, those finisher moves are pretty unsatisfying and don't feel adequate to the task. You know, it's like, I'm not convinced that you just defeated Bagul or whatever we're calling him this time. Actually, in Sinister, to its credit, lets Bagul win, which feels like the likeliest outcome for in this kind of scenario where a demon has found his way to our mortal realm.
An ancient demon.
Yeah. But that's just not how it goes in the Lanaverse. So oftentimes you do get these climaxes that are just a little bit Care Bears.
Is it the Wanaverse or the Wanaverse? That's not just a difference in pronunciation. That's two different guys.
Well, it's all multiverses now, isn't it? So they're one and the same.
Wait. You dig on multiverses?
That kid was so ahead of the fucking curve. I wonder if... Is that Wishupon? I would put decent money on it being Wishupon, which is also pre-podcast.
Yeah, that's definitely pre-podcast. And for some reason, my mind went to Freaky first. But no, it's almost certainly much older than that. I think it is Wishupon.
Well, we reviewed Freaky, and I know it's from a movie that we didn't review, but because we've been just quoting it. Although, I mean, the podcast has been around a hot minute now, but we've been quoting that for what feels like a decade, and may actually have been, depending on when Wishupon came out. My brain says 2014, but that could be wrong.
I think that's about right.
Fuck me.
Yeah, well, how about, I'm going to try and confirm that you dig on multiverses, where that's from, but in the meantime, how about you hit us with your recommendations?
Oh boy. There's a movie I watched not too long ago from the 80s, fairly obscure horror hidden gem. Not a masterpiece, but a good time, called Dream Demon. That is sort of Further-esque in its depiction of an ooky spooky alternate reality sort of layered atop our own. In that case, as the title implies, it's like dreams that the protagonist is delving into and getting lost in. I don't remember it super well, despite having watched it in, I want to say, the last 18 months or so.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got just a fun 80s feel to it. The dreams sort of have a high budget music video kind of flavor, like a vintage MTV thing, and it's got a sense of humor, a female protagonist who is kind of interesting. It's a lot of sort of girl power undercurrent. She's got a gal pal who helps her save the day, so I found it an entertaining novelty that I don't recommend with a ton of enthusiasm, but which I think does furthery sort of business in a way that is knowingly goofy rather than accidentally so, which I think is often the case in the Insidious films.
Sure. I have confirmed that Hold Up, You Dig on Multiverses is in fact a line from Wishupon, which is not quite as old as we thought. It's 2017, so that's still six goddamn motherfucking years ago now, but it's not, you know, nine. So.
I mean, frankly, that line could have cropped up in Spider-Man No Way Home. The world just wasn't ready in 2017 for what that kid was spinning. But
clearly not.
We've caught up.
We certainly have. I guess the tack I'm going to take on recommendations is the trope of haunted kid or kids grow up and are still dealing with stuff. Obviously, kind of the granddaddy of that trope is It, namely the back half. I'm referring to the 1990 TV movie / miniseries. I can't remember. I think it was broadcast in two parts, so I guess technically it's a miniseries, rather than Andy Muschietti's pair of films, because longtime listeners of this podcast know how we feel about Chapter 2 specifically, that is to say, not charitably. But yeah, obviously the original adaptation is very much worth checking out. Another good option, also Stephen King adaptation, and something we have reviewed for the podcast, is Dr. Sleep. It's about Danny Torrance post The Shining, kind of grappling with his demons, not in quite so literal a sense as as in these Insidious films, but still. In terms of something that we haven't dealt with either directly or tangentially in a podcast episode, I'm going to recommend Mike Flanagan's Haunting of Hill House Netflix series. It follows a group of, what is it, like five or six siblings? There's quite a few of them.
Yeah.
Who grew up in this kind of spooky house a few decades back, and a bunch of bad shit happened to them, and their mom died in that house, and it's sort of the after effects of that place have all hit them pretty hard. It's very good. I like all three of Mike Flanagan's Netflix shows, but that one is probably my favorite. Midnight Mass is also very good, but not really related to this episode, so not time for a recommendation. But anyway, Haunting of Hill House, Netflix, worth watching. The indestructible, lipstick-faced, fire-faced demon man, Kroger brand Darth Maul, has been painted over in black, so...
You want a better KO for these fucking things, stick them in the dip. That would feel more definitive. That stuff doesn't fuck around.
No. I'll never forget that shoe.
Yeah, I made short work of that shoe, I tell you.
But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Insidious: The Red Door official trailer HD, uploaded by Sony Pictures Entertainment. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, July 30th, and we will be discussing Cobweb, wherein a boy stuck in a haunted house fears his parents are in on the nefarious happenings. See you then.